Hello, everyone. I'm Tori.
And I'm Kariana.
And welcome to God in All Things. Today, I'm so excited to report that we are discussing one of my favorite books of all time, Tessa of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy. We have all sorts of things to say about it. So let's start with a brief little synopsis about it, and then we'll get into personal experiences and the gospel principle, and then we can finally just discuss this wonderful book. So Tess is a lower class, innocent young girl dealing with the neglect of her parents and the responsibility of caring for her siblings while also dreaming of the future, as all young women do. However, when her father learns of their nightly history, Tess's mother comes up with a scheme to match her with some wealthy relations. Unfortunately, her naivete will mean Tess's undoing, and those dreams Tess has long held will quickly be torn from her grasp. So, you can tell. You can probably tell it's a tragedy. It is a very sad book. Personal experience. I'll let Kariana start because I probably have way more to say than she does.
Wow. So, throw off the schedule.
Yes, I am. I'm going to mix it up this time. Okay. I'll let Kariana go first.
Okay. So this is my first time reading this novel. I've heard Tori talk about it lots and lots. I told Tori that I was going to save the first time I ever learned about this novel.
Yes, that's right. I forgot about that.
So she has no idea the first time I ever heard about this novel because it's so funny. Okay, so I heard about it for the first time in high school, and that's when it got put on my to read list, because every book that like gets talked about in another book ends up on my to read list. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, well, if this is worth bringing up in literature, then obviously I should read it. I don't know how many people are gonna see what's coming, because it is the favorite book of the main character in 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Which I did not actually read in high school, but I had my best friend's mom bought a copy for her, and so we decided it would be hilarious to read it out loud. And so I she gave me this copy of this book because she wanted me to like read it in really silly dramatic voices. And so we read like the first chapter. Or such, I don't know, of the book, like, and just really silly dramatic voices. Yeah, that was her favorite book. I didn't actually like fact check myself on this, so hopefully I'm not mixing it up with a different novel and a different heroine. But
Wait, now I'm curious.
That's my memory. You're gonna fact check
me. I'm going to look it up.
I think I don't want to know, because if I'm wrong, then I have literally no idea what novel it was, and that just makes me really uncomfortable.
I won't spill the beans on here.
Okay.
But
okay.
Unless you're right, then we can be like, yeah, you're right.
50 Shades of Grey is no literary masterpiece, but what intrigued me the most about it was the numerous references to Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. She's writing an essay on Tess as the novel starts. And Christian Grey sends her copies of the first editions of Tess. That's what
nice.
I remembered.
Okay, yep. So you are correct. That is a very interesting choice for that book, I gotta say. I don't know if it's trying to say it's similar or not, but I would say it's not. I haven't even read it, but I have a feeling.
I'm sure the author tries to draw similarities between the relationships.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
But yeah, so anyway, there you go. That's how I learned about it. It's been on my radar ever since.
And then you became friends with me.
And then Tori always talked about it, and so I knew I would read it eventually. And then here we are. And I don't really know what to say about this book, because I honestly feel really meh about it. Mm-hmm. Like, it just feels fine.
Okay.
Like, there were really good descriptions, but I didn't feel like I connected with the writing the same way I have with other things. Not that I would complain about the writing at all, mm-hmm. but yeah, I wasn't just like in awe of the writing all the time, and I wasn't in awe of the story. I really, really loved when her and Angel are falling in love.
Mm-hmm.
That sequence, mm-hmm. I really, really enjoy. But the rest of it, I don't know, is like maybe just like the second half was meh for me.
Okay,
maybe that's my problem. Mm-hmm. Because I know that like section drew out a lot of really strong emotions for me, and you know, the main like our main annoying horrible Angel moment draws out a lot of strong emotions for me. And I know that Tess's depression drew out a lot of strong emotions for me. But I think ending this book, it was just kind of like, we're sad and it's not working out. And then it mm-hmm. doesn't work. Like, you know, like yeah. it was just kind of like, I didn't feel super, super strongly.
It probably didn't help that you went in knowing the whole thing was sad, too. Because once you get past the like happy stuff, it's kind of like you don't know what specifically is going to happen. But, you know, like the rest of the book is not happy. So,
yeah,
like you're not expecting anything to change from that, really.
I agree. Going in knowing less about it mm-hmm. could have definitely changed, like, you know, if I like had hope the entire time mm-hmm. that like something was actually going to go well,
yeah,
then that definitely could have changed the experience of it.
Yeah.
Whereas instead it was like, I know this book is sad and it's sad.
Yeah.
And like, okay, you
and it's
know.
Still sad. Yeah.
And there mm-hmm. were parts throughout the middle that were like sad enough, like to make me feel really strongly about it. Mm-hmm. But overall, I would say that I was like, okay, yeah, like that's obviously a really well-written book mm-hmm. that I am glad that I read, but I can move on from pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. That was not my experience at all.
Now Tori will offer you an entirely different experience.
I would say this, to start off, I would say this is the book that made me fall in love with Victorian literature. Mm. So there's also that nostalgia. But also every time I reread it, I'm like, oh yeah. And even just flipping through, because I didn't actually read it this time, I should say, right off, because I was like, I know it well enough. And we'll get into why more in depth in a second. But I know it well enough that I was like, I literally don't need to. I know everything that happens. I remember everything. I even remember specific lines and stuff. But anyway, I read this in high school in my AP literature class. It was one of the ones, we actually read Wuthering Heights first. So I had read Wuthering Heights, but Wuthering Heights was a little bit of a weird experience for me. So I feel like it's not always the best one to start with for Victorian literature. It can be for certain
people.
But
that is the one that got me into Victorian literature.
But for some reason, just didn't click with me at the time. It did better once we've discussed it in class, and so for a while I did consider it one of my favorites. But towards the second half of the year, we read Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy, and I just fell in love with it. I think it helped a lot, too, that my teacher loved it. It was one of her favorite books, too, so you could feel the passion, and she was very clear that it was one of her favorite books. Like, she wasn't hiding it or anything.
It's gotta be to try it with a high school class.
Yes. And it's like so dramatic, though. Seriously, I mean, for a Victorian literature book to read in school, it's probably a decent option because it's really dramatic. There's like constantly things happening that are just over the top. But it was good. And then I just treated it as one of my favorite books of all time, if not my favorite book. I think I did refer to it as my favorite book for a long time. And then I listened to it on audiobook not long, like a few years later, I think right before my mission, I like reread it via audiobook and really enjoyed that. And then I'm pretty sure a year or two after my mission, I listened to it again. But I'm not 100% sure on that. I feel like I did listen to audiobooks twice for it. But I know for sure I reread it probably like 2 years ago. I reread it physically and I deeply annotated it. If you want my in-depth thoughts on all sorts of things in it, I have a 3-hour video on my YouTube channel, Good Strong Words, where I discuss in-depth a lot of things about this. So if you're interested in getting into that and want to watch a Lord of the Rings extended edition version of my thoughts, then you can check it out there. I just love this book so much. There's also the mini series, which I loved as well, and I've seen multiple times, which also helps me to know the story really well because they did a pretty good job. There's definitely a few changes, but honestly, like, very, very small changes, frankly. Plus, it had Eddie Redmayne in it, so how could you not want to watch that sometimes, you know? So
one of the greatest actors
yes,
of our generation.
Honestly. So, yes, I still consider this one of my favorite books of all time. I think it's probably pretty close to Wuthering Heights. I think, depending on my mood, I would say one or the other is my favorite. But I just love it so much. And I'm excited to chat about it. Even though Cariona's emotions are meh about it, she still had thoughts that we discussed. Yeah. And so it's good.
There are thoughts and emotions. It's great. Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
All right. So let's talk about the gospel principle as written and discussed by Kariana, and then we will get into the plot of the book.
Okay. So we decided to talk about the restoration and the blessings of the restoration with Tess. And so the restoration of the gospel in the latter days can change the perspectives that we use to judge ourselves and others throughout life. With the knowledge that we have gained through Christ's restored church on the earth, including modern day prophets and revelation we have because of it, we understand how the plan of salvation offers love and mercy to all of God's children, no matter the circumstances. Because of the restoration, we can be confident that God cares more about our current trajectory than our past mistakes, and we have the opportunity to spread that same forgiveness and understanding to others as we all struggle with this small part of God's eternal plan.
Great. So yeah, I'm excited to discuss this in reference to Tess, just because I feel like a lot of the issues and concerns Thomas Hardy brings up in the story would have gone so differently if he had an understanding of the restoration of the gospel. So let's kick it off with our very first chapter of Tess, which is a seemingly insignificant and kind of strange interaction between a rickety man who's clearly drunk and a parson who's on horseback passing him in the road. They say hi to each other and the parson says, "Hello, Sir John." And this man is like, "I'm sorry, what did you just call me? I'm not a Sir John. I'm just like a normal John Derbyfield. Like, that's my name. That's all I am." And the parson explains to him that he was looking in the parish records and recognized that this John Derbyfield has ancestry dating back to the Conqueror, William the Conqueror, who were knights, the D'Urbervilles. And this man, John, is just very taken by this idea and is like, "What? This is amazing." And the parson's like, "It's really not that big of a deal." As they would say nowadays, it's not that deep.
It's not the new thing.
It is. It's not even that new. Anyway, yeah, so John takes this and runs. So then we flash over to a different setting, not too far away, where this young girl is focused in on. It's the May Day dance. And so there's a group of young women, virgins, who are dancing, and it's like this big kind of celebration thing. And Tess Derbyfield ends up being a part of this group and is having fun with her friends. And they see her dad riding past in a carriage, in a little tiny, not even a carriage, it's some sort of something that he ordered to drive him because he found out he's basically like royalty. And so he deserves to be doing this even though they have no money. Anyway, and he's just yelling to everybody that he comes from this knightly ancestry, and everybody's like, "Oh my gosh, this guy's crazy." He's known in the town for being a drunk and a little bit crazy. And so the girls kind of make fun of him, and Tess tries to stand up for him, and it's kind of a sweet little interaction where you see how much she cares about her family, but also like recognizes the issues. Yeah. Recognizes that her dad is crazy. And during this dance, there are three young brothers who are walking past, and one of them ends up deciding to go and join the women for a dance. His brothers refuse to. They're like, "Oh no," they're a little more higher class, and so they're like, "Ugh, we can't just be dancing around with a bunch of country girls. That's so unseemly." And he's like, "Whatever, you guys are ridiculous. I'm just gonna go." But he's the only man, because all the other men in the village are still at work. And so they're all like, "You're gonna have to choose one girl to dance. Who are you going to choose?" And he ends up choosing some random girl, and Tess is very hurt by this. She's like, "Why didn't he choose me?" And they have kind of a little moment where they like meet each other's eyes, and he kind of wishes that he had asked her, and then he ends up leaving. So it doesn't seem like that significant, but it becomes more significant later on, especially for Tess. So anyway, after this, Tess ends up going home and talking with her parents, and they tell her about this interaction he had with the parson, and then they tell her basically her dad's too drunk to go to market where he sells certain items. He's kind of like a buyer and seller of goods, and he's too drunk to go. And then the mom ends up getting too drunk to go and help out either. So Tess is like, "No, we have to do this, because if we miss it, we're gonna be lost for money. Like, it would be a big financial difficulty for them." And so she ends up going with her younger brother to go bring these things, these items to market. And on the way, there's an horrible accident that causes the horse. It's the middle of the night. She's exhausted. And so she ends up falling asleep. And there's this accident where the horse ends up being kind of run through by another carriage. And so they end up having to shoot it to put it out of its misery, basically. And so this horse was really critical. Like I said, her dad's a buyer and seller of goods. And so that was the way he transported those goods. And so now they don't really have any way to make money. They're really destitute anyway. And throughout all of this, her mom has come up with an idea. She has learned about some D'Urbervilles who live nearby. And her mom gets it into her head that she's going to try to set Tess up with this man who's part of this family, these D'Urbervilles, because supposedly they're distant relations based on their recent discovery of this Knightley connection. Tess is really against this for a while, but after the passing of the horse, Tess really blames herself, and her mom is not nice about it and manipulates her and tells her it is her fault, basically trying to get her to take responsibility in a way where she'll go to these wealthy relations and ask for help. So finally, Tess does feel bad enough that she just gives in and is like, okay, I'll go, even though I think it's ridiculous. Like, we don't know these people. Why would we go to them for help? Why would they give it? But she does go to appease her mother. And this... this is where we meet Alec D'Urberville, who is, as you can tell by my reaction, not a good person, and definitely not a helpful person in Tess's life. So, while she's there, she goes and visits, and she ends up meeting with Alec D'Urberville, who is the son of this wealthy woman. And he is very taken by her. She's very beautiful, and so he is flirting with her. Yeah, it's... really bad situation. And eventually she kind of is like, you know, I'm willing to work. Like, she doesn't have it in her to ask for money or anything like that, but she's like, if you have a job for me, like, I will take it and would be happy to get the income that way. And he's like, well, I'll let you know, I'll talk to my mom and we'll figure something out. Well, he just wants her to go, so he sneakily writes a fake letter from his mom, who's blind, saying, hey, can you come help with the birds? Which he does need someone to help with the birds, but it's very like he's pretending to be his mom, inviting her to do this. And so Tess has a job, and her mom's overjoyed, over the moon about it. She gets her all dressed, dolled up to go, to make sure she looks gorgeous, unfortunately. All of it's so unfortunate. And Alec ends up being the one to come pick her up, just because he wants to come pick her up and help her out that way.
Yeah, he's so helpful.
I know, how helpful of him. And then there's this weird carriage scene that just makes you want to push him off the carriage. But anyway, basically he like makes it go really fast where she's scared and uncomfortable, and she asks him to stop, and he's like, only if you give me a kiss. And she's like, no, I don't want to. And he's like, fine, I'll just go faster. And he's like going down a hill super fast with these horses, and she's like, okay, fine. And they like, he like kisses her, and she lets him, but she like wipes it off her mouth afterwards, and he's all offended. So then he keeps going fast. Eventually she comes up with a trick to make her hat blow off, and is like, oh, my hat, let me stop so I can go get my hat, please. And he's like, will you kiss me for real this time? And she's like, okay, but let me get my hat first. And then as soon as she's off and grabs her bonnet, she starts just walking instead of him driving. And he's all like, how, why would you do that? You're so artful. You're so deceitful. Gross. Anyway, so she walks the whole rest of the way to Trantridge, where his house is, and he just kind of rides alongside her. After that, she's stubborn enough, which I think is just a great scene to just see her personality. Like, we see before this, there's a lot of moments of depression. There's this really depressing scene where she's talking to her younger brother on the cart before the horse gets hit, about how all of the stars, he's like, what are the stars? And she's like, I think they're a bunch of planets. And he's like, oh, what are the planets like, Tess? And she's like, they're so some good ones and some blighted ones. And he's like, which one are we on? And she says, a blighted one. So like, she's clearly already very depressed, but you see in this little fire in her, even though she's gone through a lot with her parents and just poverty and everything that goes along with that. But she really has some spunk to her, has some fire in her, which makes the rest of the story a lot more tragic, because you see she kind of keeps that on some level, and maybe it flares up in a way that's not as healthy as it could have been. Like, she had so much potential to be a well-rounded individual who has a lot of things going on and isn't perfect, but has, you know, a lot of color to her. But then that color is turned into a very different shade than it probably would have been by the end of this book. But anyway, it's a really interesting and awful scene, this carriage scene. So anyway, they get to the farm and she basically is just there working with the birds. This blind woman, Alec's mother, has a whole bunch of birds that she loves to hear their song, and she likes to touch them. They're kind of like her babies. She loves them. And so Tess is there to take care of them, and there's a lot of weird interactions with Alec throughout this. He ends up like saying that he bought her family some various things, various items for her, and she was like, oh, that's really nice. And he flirts with her and teases her. And in the miniseries adaptation, I really like the way it's portrayed, because it's very much like she has moments where she laughs with him, and she has moments where she's a little more friendly with him. And they have like interactions that in a romance movie would feel like they belonged there. Like they were kind of in that range, but there's always like this sense of like tension of like she's uncomfortable and he's a little bit predatory. Like there's something off about all of the interactions, and it's very well done. I think the acting and the writing in that really helped to build that up. And so if you haven't seen that, you definitely should. It's very well done. So all this flirtation's happening, and there's also a lot of judgment from her coworkers because of this flirtation, and there's hints here and there of like a previous girl who was there before Tess, who Tess kind of replaced, who like mysteriously left. And so there's like these hints of maybe Alec did something to her. It's not super clear necessarily that that's maybe where your mind should go, but there's like hints that when things do kind of happen that you're like, oh, that probably is what happened to this previous girl who was there. But anyway, we get to this one night where Tess ends up agreeing to go to this kind of dance at a dance hall in town with some coworkers, and they just really don't treat her very well, especially because Alec ends up being there and is once again flirting with her and chatting with her, wanting to dance with her. She is just very clear of like, I'm not interested in you. Like, I'm sorry, I appreciate what you've done for my family and I feel a lot of gratitude for you, but that's all. And of course he doesn't like that, but anyway, he leaves. And then she starts walking home with her coworkers pretty late at night, and they start attacking her because one of them has some sort of fiasco. She gets like a tankard of something, some big bucket or something of some sort of treat or drink or something, and it ends up breaking a little bit, so it trickles down her back, and they kind of make fun of her. And Tess, because everybody else is laughing as well, but of course this woman who's jealous of Tess ends up picking on her and is like, how dare you laugh at me, like super offended. And then everybody else kind of gangs up on Tess as well, and then who should appear on his white horse? Alec d'Urberville. He comes charging in, and it's interesting because Thomas Hardy makes it clear that he was kind of watching in the bushes while everything happened and then decided to show up to save Tess. And so she's kind of put between a rock and a hard place, and so she ends up going with Alec because at least he's being nice to her. So she does that, and on the way out, classic unfortunate line, one of the older women, she ends up saying out of the frying pan and into the fire, which, you know, we don't fully understand quite yet, but you can get a feel for it of she was in this hot spot with all of these coworkers treating her bad, but now she's just jumped into something she expected to be saved but actually is not, is much worse. And so then we go right into the next chapter, which is the final chapter of Phase the First, in which basically Alec is taking her. She ends up falling asleep briefly, and when she wakes up, they're still not back to the house, and they should have been. And she asks him what's going on, and he's like, oh, I'm afraid I got us a little lost. and she's upset because obviously he knows these woods. He's grown up there. He didn't just get them lost casually on accident. So she hops down and starts storming off, and Alex like, whoa, wait, like, it's fine. You just stay here. I'll just go and look up over this hill and see if I can see anything. It's foggy, so he can't see super well where they're at. So he's like, I'll go check up here and see if I can see anything familiar, and we'll be able to get back on track. And she's like, okay. He leaves her with his jacket and goes up, and she ends up laying the jacket down and laying down to fall asleep because she's just exhausted from this day. And suffice it to say, he comes back and takes advantage of her while she's lying there. And so that is where we end the first phase, is with this terrible event where Alec takes advantage of her in her sleep. And it's really sad. Thomas Hardy just has to make it extra emotional talking about her ancestors and how they as knights probably did similar things to other young women, and how maybe this is payback, but also it just still feels wrong. And we see a big glimpse, I think, at this point of Hardy's struggle in some ways with religion. He says, I'm gonna skip around a little bit, but he says, where was Tess's guardian angel? Where was the providence of her simple faith? Doubtless some of Tess D'Urberville's mailed ancestors rollicking home from a fray had dealt the same measure even more ruthlessly towards peasant girls of their time. But though to visit the sins of the fathers upon the children may be a morality good enough for divinities, it is scorned by average human nature, and it therefore does not mend the matter. So he's addressing the idea of original sin and Adam and Eve and the fall, and we've discussed this a couple times on our podcast about how so many people see Eve as the villain of the story instead of recognizing God probably knew this was going to happen all along and put people in place who would do that so that the rest of his plan could move forward. But at this point, Thomas Hardy is living at a point where he doesn't have easy access to that knowledge at this point. Like, he is far away from that. The restoration has occurred. Joseph Smith and him bringing back the priesthood and the revelation, the modern revelation, the living prophet is there. Thomas Hardy's writing in like the later 1800s, but he doesn't have this understanding. And I think in a lot of his books, he explores a lot about faith and religion and his personal struggles with it in kind of more subtle ways that are part of his stories, but you definitely can feel that lost soul feeling there. Like, he knows that there has to be something out there he's missing, but he doesn't know what. And as time goes by, if you learn more about his life and his internal struggles and stuff, you learn that he did eventually, by the end of his life, kind of give up on the idea of God. And I think you can see that a little bit too with Angel and his perspectives on things a lot in this book. But I think this is a great example of, as the narrator, Hardy being like, it seems unfair to have the idea of the sins of the fathers coming down on the heads of the children. And we, with modern revelation and the Book of Mormon, learn that that's not true, that men are responsible for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression or anybody else's since then. And I think it's such an interesting concept, because I think we live in a world where that's still such a belief, is the idea of original sin. Like, you see so many things of like, oh, your ancestors did this to my ancestors, so therefore I can hate you, even though we're not the same people. That doesn't mean we should ignore the problems of the past and not acknowledge them as issues, but also keeping in mind that everybody is their own person and that they deserve to have their own life's journey to growth the same way their ancestors did, even if their ancestors failed to do it as well as they could have. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that's a really early sign in this book that there's some sort of disconnect, that you're like, if he had the blessing of the restoration knowledge that we have, I don't know that he would have written that. You know, I think he may have told a similar story, but it would have been approached in such a different way.
I think we can also see, similar to what you're talking about, it can be difficult to kind of wrap our heads around, because we definitely see examples of it even in the scriptures. You kind of get the idea, you know, of like the sins of the fathers on mm-hmm. the children kind of thing, where we were talking about this a little bit earlier. One thing that I think about a lot, and one thing that I kind of had to like struggle with and figure out, like how this all worked, was with Jews because, right, because they're the ones who crucified Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's, I think, a big part of why Jews have been persecuted throughout Christian history.
Yeah.
Because there's that resentment for that, and the scriptures kind of prophesy something like that happening, like bad things happening mm-hmm. to Jews in the future as a punishment for that. And so I know for me, it was kind of hard to wrap my head around, like, no, that's not why bad things have happened to Jews mm-hmm. in modern history, because it's not like God is punishing Jews for crucifying Christ. It's because Christians have made the choice mm-hmm. to persecute Jews for whatever reasons, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of trying to end that eternal question of why does God let bad things happen, you know, mm-hmm. figuring out that it's because of agency that bad things happen, agency in a fallen world, and not necessarily because of what previous sinners have done mm-hmm. who eventually led the line down to you. And so, yeah, I guess for me, that's like where the danger lies mm-hmm. is that kind of thought process. And that's where I've had to kind of figure things out. It's also interesting to me that he says that it's a morality good enough for the divinities, but it's scorned by average human nature. And we mm-hmm. kind of made this comment before when we were talking about it, that I kind of feel like it's flipped, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I can see where he's coming from. I can see where he would say that human nature is to not want to carry the sins of the father to the children. But just like the point you made a minute ago, mm-hmm. we do, you know, mm-hmm. we blame people all the time. I mean, how many family grudges exist mm-hmm. throughout history, right? That last generations and generations across all different cultures. It's a very, very natural thing for us to say, well, your dad did that and therefore you're bad and I'm gonna hate you too. Mm-hmm. And that has created all sorts of divides on all different levels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, like you're saying, unbeknownst to most people throughout history, God does not see it that way. And God is willing to give us all that clean slate and let us make our own choices, which can be biased and influenced negatively by looking at other people as the sins of their fathers. And so, yeah, I think he really, really just has it backwards. And I can see where that creates a more difficult, cynical outlook on life when you're like, obviously, people don't deserve this. You know, he can mm-hmm. recognize people don't deserve this. So why is God doing that? And it would be a lot easier for him.
Especially when the God you've learned about your whole life is that kind of God, where you're mm-hmm. like, I'm being taught that this is what God's like, but there's part of me that just doesn't believe that should be the way it is.
Right. And he's right.
Mm-hmm. And he is right. He is right.
He could tell. He could tell mm-hmm. that wasn't, he had that feeling that it wasn't right. Yeah. And so I just think it's really interesting and definitely a lesson that we can still think about and remember today, because it does come up in so many, because I think it is human nature to blame each other for the sins of our fathers.
Absolutely.
So, and we have to remember that God doesn't do that. Each person mm-hmm. is their own person.
Great. Thank you. That is great. So moving forward, we cut to the next part, which is the next phase of the story. And we see her, she's walking away from Trantridge, and this man comes up behind her and is following her, and it's Alec.
Because, it always is.
Yes.
If there's a man,
some
lurking,
shadowy figure, it's probably
Alec.
So he pops up and is like, why are you leaving? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I misunderstood what you were saying. Oh, smack him. I do want to read a little bit of their dialogue just so you can get a feel for how manipulative and how done she is. Also, how manipulative he is and how done she is. So they're walking and he's like, why did you slip away by stealth like this? And he's like, come back. It's fine. I'm so sorry. Whatever. You'll be fine. Just come back. And she's like, no, I won't. And he's like, okay, I thought you wouldn't, but let me just help you carry your basket at least. And so she's she's walking. And I love, it says, she had no fear of him now, and in the cause of her confidence, her sorrow lay, which is just so heartbreaking. Like, she's like, he's had everything he can take from me. So, like, I'm not afraid of him anymore because he's already taken everything.
What can he do?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, in a creepy way, she feels like he knows her in a way no one else does because of this interaction between them, which was not her fault. And she shouldn't feel that way. He took something that wasn't his to take. But that is how she feels. So they continue talking. And he eventually says, you didn't come for love of me, that I'll swear. And she says, 'tis quite true. If I had gone for love of you, if I had ever sincerely loved you, if I loved you still, I should not look so loathe and hate myself for my weakness as I do now. And it's so sad.
You just have to just hate, like, it. Seriously. My weakness? You're like, yeah. Literally, like,
no,
what?
It's not your
You
fault.
Mean your physical weakness that he literally overpowered you by? Yeah. Like, stop.
No, not your fault. And then she said, I didn't understand your meaning until it was too late, meaning his meaning while he was flirting with her and stuff. And he says, he has the brass to say, that's what every woman says. And she says, my gosh, I could knock you out of the gig. Did it ever strike your mind that what every woman says, some women may feel? Good on Tess. See, she still has that little bit of spark in her, but she's like so devastated at the same time. Just like, are you kidding me? I can't believe you just said that to me. Like, not even in it at all. Anyway, and then eventually he's like, just come back with me, just like be with me and I'll take care of you, basically is what he's saying. And she's like, basically, like, I would be your mistress if I did that, and I'm not gonna do that. Like, I'm like, I may be a lost soul and may feel like I have nothing left, but I'm not going to degrade myself to that extent where I'm like actively choosing to be with you. That's where she's drawing the line. And then he also has the brass to say that he was born bad and have lived bad and shall die bad in all probability, but upon my lost soul, I shall won't be bad towards you again, Test. Lies, by the way. Have you ever read this? That's a straight up lie. Anyway, and so then he forces her to let him kiss her cheeks, which is just the most painful scene. And in the miniseries, it's also done so well, where she literally has the most dead eyes ever as she, like, lets him kiss both her cheeks. And he's like, come on, you have to have love me a little bit now. And she's like, perhaps of all things, a lie on this thing would do the most good to me now, but I have honor enough left, little as 'tis, not to tell that lie. If I did love you, I may have the best of causes for letting you know it, but I don't. Her honesty, she's like, I'm not going to fall into your trap further. She's like, I'm not going to pretend like there's nothing between us and like there's any sort of feeling in me where I feel like I can really say that there's nothing there, that nothing happened, because it clearly did and it's impacted me and it's impacted our relationship. But I'm not gonna lie to you, even if it would make my life better. Like, she has this great, like, stubbornness to her. That is just amazing. I love it. And so anyway, she goes home. On the way home, we have another moment where we see a little bit of Hardy's struggle with understanding the truth of the gospel, in large part due to the setting in which he's living in, where Tess ends up seeing this man, like, painting a scripture on the side of a fence. And the scripture, but of course, is thou shalt not commit adultery, because what else would it be? And he kind of has this conversation with her about, like, how terrible that is and the loss of virtue and stuff. And this is another great moment where Tess is, like, super shaken, obviously, by this. And it's like, oh my gosh, like, I've committed adultery. That's how she feels. But again, that just loss of an understanding of revelation and understanding of the scriptures that comes from more personal revelation from God, where the words are there, but they can mean different things to different people depending on setting and culture and things like that. And so they're in this world where this means, like, anything that's, like, sexual related that you do, especially as a woman, means that you are breaking that commandment and it's a big no-go. And so Tess is really feeling this, feeling like she's sinned. end, and like she's going to be sent to hell, basically. That's how she's feeling. But little did they know, even at the time, there was this living revelation going on, a living prophet who could show them like that's not what that means. And her agency, like the power of agency and sin and understanding on a deeper level, agency and the plan of salvation and what we're doing here and what it all means. And the fact that she had her agency taken away means that she was not even sort of in the wrong. Like someone else who did the taking was the one in the wrong, because they were the ones acting and using their agency to hurt someone else. I'm honestly so grateful. Even we live in a world nowadays where more people accept that as the truth in situations like this. And I truly believe, even though they're not all necessarily members of the church, that comes from the light of Christ and the light of the gospel filling the earth. So that even if people don't embrace the fullness of truth, there's greater light in the world that's able to show the direction on some of these things. And it really is such a testimony builder. I remember reading this the first time, and it was a topic that I haven't really thought much about, that idea of sexual assault and what that can mean for people. And so this was kind of my introduction into that topic a little more deeply. And the whole time reading this whole part, I was like, but Tess, no. Like, you don't even know, like, God loves you so much, and it's not your fault, and your agency is so precious, and your virtue isn't gone the way they're saying it is. You know, I just, man, I'm so grateful to be part of a living church.
I think it is really powerful that we teach about agency so much, and mm-hmm. that it's often considered the greatest gift that God yeah. has ever, it's the one thing that's like, wholly ours, right? Mm-hmm. That God gave us and that he can't take away, and that yeah, that it's solely ours to be able to use and abuse. And one thing that I think is really interesting about Tessa's situation is that it's like most, if not all, people recognize that she's been sinned against.
Yeah,
like everybody mm-hmm. says that. Alex says, I've wrong, you know, like yeah. I'm sorry, I did something wrong, you yeah. know. Mm-hmm. And Angel later says, I'll admit that you've been sinned against more than you've sinned yourself. And like people in her town feel bad for her, like mm-hmm. there's a recognition that something horrible and invasive and wrong happened to her, and yet she's still corrupted. Yes. Like, it's just this fascinating concept to me that, like, everybody recognizes, like, there is a recognition that it wasn't her fault and that she didn't want it and that mm-hmm. that wasn't her intention. But it, like, doesn't matter. It's yeah. like this idea that someone else can take away your virtue. That virtue is, like, not built in your intention and your morality and your spirit and your agency and what you do with it, but rather built into, like, facts surrounding you yeah. almost. mm-hmm. Which just honestly, like, I can't even justify, like, I don't even know how to yeah. make sense of that anywhere.
It makes
you
no
know
sense.
And yeah, and so, like, you know, kind of the opposite of what I was talking about earlier, where, like, you can almost justify in the scriptures the concept of original sin and mm-hmm. Adam's transgression. Not almost, like, you can yeah. with mm-hmm. the scriptures yeah. you can mm-hmm. justify that concept, but with this I'm like, what? Yeah.
Where, like, does it lead you to believe that the corruption is comes from, like, mechanical actions
yeah.
rather than, and things that are acted upon rather than just your own choices?
Right. You know? Exactly. I think that's just an absolutely fascinating concept, which is why I think the way the church teaches about agency is so important, because it's something that ultimately no one can take away. Mm-hmm. Physically, sure, you can be overpowered, right? Like, your physical, you have physical limitations that can be overpowered, but ultimately your agency, what you do with what happens to you by whatever external forces they may be, is all yours. Mm-hmm. It's all yours. And that's why she's still pure, right? Mm-hmm. And I just feel so sad that she doesn't know that. And honestly, yeah. her own hatred of herself is the worst part of mm-hmm. the entire book, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, like, her own honestly. Self-loathing, where I'm like, literally, oh my gosh, like, you're wrong, Tess, you know? And that's just what I want to scream is about agency. And I'll second you where I'm just so grateful for the restoration and for the revelation that has helped us understand why, you know, because you're right, like the world has kind of moved to a point where like there's more of an understanding of that. I think it comes from a place of like sexual freedom and being allowed to do what you want, which is not, you know,
yeah, no,
this is a good thing that has come from that. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm grateful to have a church that can help us direct that understanding and understand like why this can happen and she can still be a pure, virtuous, chaste daughter of God. Despite it. Just to very specifically talk about the restoration, I wanted to the restoration proclamation I think is
great place to go.
Easy starting point for understanding what it is we're talking about. Beautiful and wonderful, and I love it.
Yes.
And so I just want to quote a little bit from the first paragraph. It's a really simple sentiment and statement. And if you've grown up a member of the church, you know this. But it's just, but it's so important too, which is why President Nelson gave it to us. So he says, God the Father has given us the divine birth, the incomparable life, and the infinite atoning sacrifice of his beloved Son, Jesus Christ. By the power of the Father, Jesus rose again and gained the victory over death. He is our Savior, our Exemplar, and our Redeemer. Those words mean something, you know? It's so easy to just skip over them. But the word Redeemer means something. It means you're redeemed. And the word Savior means something. It means you're saved, you know? Like, no matter what feelings you're going through, whether they're self-induced or caused by external factors, it's just that beautiful message of the restoration that everything, the infinite atoning sacrifice, everything is covered by this, no matter where that lies. And I mean, I think that's the most beautiful truth of the restoration is this, you know, getting rid of this hypocrisy, you know, Pharisaical religion, this lack of agency, original sin, all of those things that take away from Christ's ability to atone for you as an individual, for your mistakes and your trials and everything. And so I love that that's the first paragraph, and I love that, and it felt right to quote the Restoration Proclamation here.
I love that. That's great. Thank you. Continuing forward a little bit, so she gets home and she's like, oh yeah, we're here. I'm here. It's all great. She's trying to put on a good face at first. And her siblings are all like, oh my gosh, you're back. Are you going to marry him? Are you going to marry your cousin? And eventually Tess literally just breaks down and she's like, no, I'm not going to marry him. It's so sad. Oh my gosh. That's like another part in the miniseries, especially, that I burst into tears too, because she literally is just like, nope. Just bursts into tears herself, just crying. And then her mom takes her aside and they have this conversation. And basically the mom's like, why didn't you marry him? Like, what? You're such an idiot, basically. Like, you should have made him marry you. If he was gonna do that, you may as well have married him and gotten us all this money. And then she has the brass to say, I'm gonna say that a lot. Anyway, she says, you ought to have been more careful if you didn't mean to get him to make you his wife. And finally, Tess breaks out after this, is like, how could I be expected to know? I was a child when I left this house 4 months ago. Why didn't you tell me there was danger in menfolk? Why didn't you warn me? Ladies know what to fend against, hands against, because they read novels that tell them of these tricks. But I never had the chance of learning in that way, and you did not help me. That's also a really sad, this like sense of her parents not being the type of people who could prepare her for this. And there's also a big theme, just kind of a side note, but connected with Tess and her tragedy. Hardy explores a lot to do in his books with like education and the pros and cons of gaining education. He'll talk a lot about like things where they're lower class and so they miss certain understandings that make their lives harder. But also education, he explores a lot in his books, makes people unsettled, or like they're not happy, they're not content anymore where they're at. And so they seek for something else, but then they can't really get happy, become happy, because of this understanding and awareness of things that they can't leave alone. So it's a really interesting concept. But in this moment, he's taking that former perspective of this girl who has such little education that it gets her into trouble and just doesn't have these role models. And I think it's such a blessing in the Restoration too, just like not only that we have modern day Revelation, a living church to be a part of, but also that there are prophets, seers, and revelators that are around us. So even if you're in a position where you are lost and you don't have parents maybe you can look up to, there's people available, readily available to help mentor you and guide you. Obviously, on a general level, there are people who can direct you into what actually is true, what's actually there to protect you. But also, the way the church is set up is to bring people together. It's set up in wards where people can meet and have found family situations. They can connect with men and women in their ward, they can connect with their bishop, they can connect with other leaders and mentors that enable them where if they're in a situation like this, where they have parents who aren't there to help them, to protect them and guide them and strengthen them, they have other options. Not meaning that nothing bad will ever happen or nothing like this would ever happen when you have those connections, but you're more protected and you have a support system. Like Tess is coming out of this situation, not only having not been prepared for it and not been in a position to fend it off, but even after it's happened, she doesn't have anywhere to go. She's trying to talk to her mom, and her mom's also blaming her and not helping her understand what happened or helping her feel better or helping to comfort her. Really, she like has a second of doing it and then is like, well, you should have been better, you should have been smarter. And it just makes Tess feel more alone than ever, and it's just super tragic. And so the fact that God has set up his church in a way where we don't have to feel like that is another beautiful thing that I think we take for granted a lot. Like a lot of other churches don't have that same level of organization and connection that ours do, and it's really a miracle.
I was actually thinking of kind of a little but big example of that, you know, small and simple means. Earlier today, I was kind of thinking about, this is about you, about how actually like going to church is just hard on my social interests. And I just don't enjoy it like that much, if I'm being completely honest, all the time. And with my family, I hated going to church alone. I've always hated going to church alone. Mm-hmm. When I lived with my mom and I was the only one who went to church, like I just hated it. And when I went to a singles ward alone, I hated it. Mm-hmm. But when I have gone with my dad, it's an interesting thing, because then I have like, you know, I have people there who go to church, but it's still just such a complicated family dynamic, you know, that mm-hmm. there have always just still been issues there. And so I enjoy going to church with my dad and my brother more, but there's still difficulties to it, just kind of emotionally. And I was thinking about it and thinking, dang, it's actually, since moving in with Tori, been so much easier to go to church. And you've seen me still struggle sometimes, where I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't want to, or oh my gosh, this person is annoying, or I'm just so done today. But like, there's never like a question of whether or not I'm going to go to church. Yeah, it's just something that's easier to look forward to and to want to do at least first hour.
Yeah. Yes.
And more frequently, like I was saying, on an overall level, you know, like it's easier to have somebody who, yeah, is just, you know, just knowing that I have people there who I'm going to get to sit next to and who are supportive. And it goes beyond that too, where I know I can like hear something that frustrates me and I can always come to Tori and be like, okay, Tori, this thing frustrated me and I don't know how I feel about it and I just need a different perspective on it. And Tori's always ready to just offer a different perspective and think about things and like, okay, well, like, you know, there's this factor and this factor and, you know, and it just makes it easier to just continue to understand the gospel better and not get like hung up on things as much and instead like actually think through things and work through things. And yeah, and just like you're saying, that support. So thanks for being such a supportive friend in the gospel.
Well, thank you for telling me that. That's so tender. Well, I'm happy to. I'm honestly glad to, because I feel like my desire to go to church has decreased Not necessarily since living with you, even before that.
I know. I'm the bad influence. No, you increase my desire while I take years. Apparently, there's a finite amount of desire to go to church in this relationship. Yes.
Apparently, we just spread it a little bit. That's all that happened. Just no. Still want to go. Still good. Just.
Yes.
You know.
Seasons of life.
Those things. Seasons of life. Exactly. So anyway, back to Tess. She does end up getting pregnant and she has a baby. And long story short, the baby does pass away, gets sick and dies. And the father...
It's kind of a short story, actually.
It really is a short story.
A shockingly short story of her having this baby and it dying.
Yes. Part of the story, though, that's really important is that before it died, they were trying to get it baptized because, you know, they believe in the idea of if the child's not baptized, it's not going to go to heaven. Regardless of how old it is or whatever. And so they want to get it baptized, but the dad is drunk and is really upset about Tessa's situation and the shame it's put on their family. And so he refuses to let anybody out to go get the parson that night. And by the end of the night, the baby is dead. And while she does end up, Tess ends up taking it upon herself, deciding to just be like, okay, I'm just going to baptize it really quick so that it's safe. Hopefully that will work and it will be good enough. And she has her siblings witness it and everything. And so anyway, the baby passes away. She goes and talks to the parson and is like, hey, I know my baby wasn't baptized, but I tried to baptize it myself. Like, can we just give him a Christian burial? And if you don't know anything about the Anglican Church, especially at this time, they believed that a baby or anybody who hasn't been baptized doesn't deserve to be buried in the normal church graveyard. They're end up being buried somewhere else, along with any other like sinners, drunks, suicides as well, are just kind of cast aside because of the sinful nature of them and the unworthiness to be buried in holy ground. And so she goes and talks to the parson about this, and the parson's like, no, sorry, like that's not the rule, like I can't go against the tradition and expectations, like I just can't do it. And she basically brings up the point of like, but this baby who's never sinned in his life, like to just bury him with all of these sinners, it's just a terrible, wicked thing. And the parson's like, my heart is with you. And like, she even at one point is like, tell me, I'll read it because it's just well done. She asks, perhaps it will be just the same for him if you don't give him a Christian burial. Will it be just the same? Don't for heaven's sake speak as a saint to sinner, but as you yourself to me myself. And finally, he like doesn't have the heart to go all the way and say, no, you're wrong. So he just says, it will be just the same. But then he follows up with, but I can't give him a Christian burial. I'm sorry. And she basically storms out of there as she should. And that's another great example of if she had the restoration and understood, if Thomas Hardy had the restoration and understood, they would know that that's not true. In the Book of Mormon, it has, I wish I remembered what verse, do you know off the top of your head where it is? Anyway, the verse that talks about how little children do not need to be baptized because they're born in innocence, and up to a certain age, the age of accountability, where they are at a point where they are prepared to understand the covenant they make and right and wrong much more on a deeper level, they don't need to be baptized. And so that just would have made such a difference for someone like her, who's already suffering so much because of society and because of her own feelings about herself and her community and her family, to know that her baby is going to be just fine. Like, he's automatically going straight to heaven. Like, he's going to be just fine. But she just doesn't, they don't have that understanding, and it just causes even more unnecessary pain for them. I think that's a great thing to think about with the restoration. It doesn't save you from all pain, that's not the point, but it does save you from unnecessary pain. And I think this is a great example of that. She has unnecessary pain here that she doesn't need to have. It's hard enough that she was sexually assaulted and lost her baby, but to know that the baby is going to be okay would be just such a blessing, a balm to everything she's experiencing that she just doesn't know, and it's so sad.
It's kind of amazing that Thomas Hardy does seem to have so much understanding.
Yes.
It's like he's struggling with religion and you're like... Yeah, that's because you don't have the right one.
Yes.
You're like, I know a religion that you would love, yes. Mr. Hardy.
You would listen.
Yes, that's always key. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I have anything to add. I think you make beautiful points. Just that, like, you just wish so badly because you're like, you can feel the fact that he's struggling and fighting in this internal conflict. And you're like, dude, it's fine.
You don't
There's
understand.
No internal conflict. We already know. Yeah. You're good. It also looks like, just doing like a quick Google search and looking at stuff, I don't know that there's anything in the Book of Mormon. I'm not going to lie. That doesn't sound familiar to me.
I remember distinctly there's like the children.
It's in the Doctrine and Covenants. Because as Joseph Smith receives a revelation talking about his brother.
It's Moroni 8:11.
Oh, Moroni. Look, I just needed to click on this link.
But little children are alive in Christ, even from the foundation of the world. If not so, God is a partial God and also a changeable God and a respecter to persons for how many little children have died without baptism. Love that.
That's
amazing.
Beautiful.
And that's modern revelation, folks. We freaking love it. Amazing. And you just wouldn't have that same understanding. And then further, you brought up Doctrine and Covenants. Like, that's where we learned that even if they weren't baptized in this life, they still have that opportunity in the next life as we do proxy baptisms for the dead.
We freaking love the plan of salvation.
It's amazing.
The great equalizer, you could call it.
Yes, you could. God knows what he's doing. And he not only knows what he's doing, but he loves us so much, and that's where he's coming from with his knowledge and with his understanding and approach, is this focus on, I love my children and I want them to have every opportunity to come back to me. I'm not trying to trick anybody or trying to make things harder for people unnecessarily.
Right.
Like, he's not an angry, vengeful God the way it's described in many other religions. He's a very loving, caring God who will put us through hard things because it's necessary, but he will give us all the tools to avoid the unnecessary hurts if we listen to him.
Yeah. God loves Tess's baby as much as Tess loves her baby.
Yes.
And he's not
probably more.
More, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if Tess wants that baby to be saved and recognizes that he didn't do anything wrong and deserves to be saved, then God is going to recognize that too.
Yes.
And I love you mentioning that he comes at everything, like all of the knowledge that he has and everything that he does for us, he's coming at it with love for us, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought it at the beginning, but I decided not to. I thought about using the phrase, the plan of happiness, instead of, in place of the plan of salvation. I am used to the plan of salvation, mm-hmm. so that's what I usually say. But the plan of happiness honestly feels more descriptive when you're looking at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, God knows how we're happy. Mm-hmm. He knows how we're going to be happy. Not always in the short term, but in the long term. Mm-hmm. And he's going to make sure that things are worth it as long as we are doing our best mm-hmm. to follow him and do what he wants. Tess is just so miserable and upset because she doesn't know that there's a plan of happiness
mm-hmm.
and that it's okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it will all be okay.
It will all be okay. It doesn't even matter where the baby is buried.
Mm-hmm. Nope. It will all be all right. So anyway, her baby dies. She ends up creating her own little, you know, cross for it outside of the cemetery. And then she's like, I can't be around all these people who know me and know my past anymore. I just need to get away. And so she's able to get a job at a dairy farm. And this is where we enter the bright, happy space of this book.
Woohoo!
Which ends up not being that happy when the rest of the book happens. But it's a brief moment where it feels kind of happy. At this dairy farm, it's also spring and summer, because that's how Thomas Hardy works. Is the weather reflects what is happening in the story. And so during all the winter and fall months, she's miserable. And then we have the spring summertime, and she's able to cheer up a little bit. While she's there, she ends up running into this man named Angel, who happens to be the man that was at the beginning during the dance scene that I said. said didn't sound important, but actually is. So she recognizes him from that. He doesn't quite recognize her. He kind of like feels like he might have seen her before, but that's like the extent. He doesn't remember where. But she remembers. She remembers this guy. And so, long story short, we follow several chapters of them falling in love, and he really likes her because she's the prettiest girl on the farm. He's a little bit more wealthy. His father is a parson or a squire or something, some sort of more wealthy church leader. And he was going to go into the church as well, but that didn't work out, and we learn more about that later. But now he wants to go into agriculture, and so that's why he's at this dairy farm to learn more about the trade. And anyway, so he does end up falling in love with her. She falls in love with him, but of course she has all of this baggage that she just can't. She's basically like, all the other girls on the farm are also in love with him. He's just this really handsome, rich young man. So of course, and they all know that he likes Tess the best, but she's very like, no, he'll never marry me, and I promise it won't happen. And there's this really cute little like crossing the river scene where there's that been a flood.
That scene actually killed me.
Yes, it's so good. Oh my gosh. Where basically Angel comes through. They're going to church. He's not, because he has a lot of faith issues. But he walks through this water and is like, oh no, we've got to take you across. So he carries each of them across and ends with Tess. And it's just like this really sweet where they're close together, and it's, yeah, whatever. And she's pretending like it's fine, it's whatever, but like clearly they're both feeling it and it's great. And the other girls are jealous. And anyway, so they get across and go. I also, another side note, the female solidarity in this book, for a Victorian novel especially, is amazing. Crazy. Because even though these girls are jealous, there's never any real drama with that. There's like some level of it where they're obviously jealous and they like voice things, but like there's never like a big blow up. Like they stay friends.
They're like on her side the entire time. Mm-hmm.
They're like, it's fine. Like, it's amazing that any of us could be with him or anything. So love it. Anyway, this episode has been divided into two parts. You have reached the end of part one. Part two will be released the following Thursday. We hope you enjoyed the first half of our discussion. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at God and All Things Podcast. Additionally, if you are interested in seeing what Tori is currently reading, head over to her YouTube channel, Good Strong Words. Thank you again for listening. We hope you are having a wonderful day. Keep remembering to see God in all things, and we will see you next time. Bye!